This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Being a journalist in Ukraine has never been an easy matter. In fact, it's been extremely dangerous over the years. Two editors of Ukrainska Pravda, Ukrainian Truth, have been murdered over time, possibly by corrupt authorities. Sevgil Moiseeva became the editor-in-chief in 2014 when she was just in her 20s.
How are you?
Good, actually.
Where are you?
I'm not in my newsroom today. I came to business trip to Odessa. Yeah, I'm staying in hotel now, just to have a Wi-Fi connection and everything. So.
Moiseeva is from Crimea, which Russia invaded and illegally annexed in 2014. After Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine just a year ago, she started an English-language edition of Ukrainska Pravda, intending to bring news of the war to more readers in the West. I talked with Sevgil Moiseeva last week about what it's meant to run a newsroom in a time of war this past year, while destruction of every kind has engulfed her country. I want to get a sense of the morale of your newsroom, your virtual newsroom of Ukrainska Pravda, and at the same time, the morale of people around you. Talk to me about what's changed over the course of a year.
This is so interesting. My good friend of mine, Vladimir Yermolenko, who is a philosopher, in his interview to our newspaper, he told the most important thing that it's not, of course, everyone speaks now about Ukrainian resistance, but there are a lot of people who were broken by this war. And in my newsroom, even there are a lot of people who were affected by this war in a terrible way because they lost their parents, for example. One of my colleague's father was killed in Bucha in March. Another colleague lost her father because her father became a soldier and he just disappeared. And then we understood that he probably was killed in the front line. One of my colleagues joined the army. The experience of this war is unique for everyone, and everyone reflects and everyone survives this war in his personal way, in my personal way. I also go through this war.
Mm-hmm. How do you keep the spirits of the staff of Ukrainskaya Pravda in any way healthy?
So difficult question, because we have some offices around country, and I have even opportunity to travel abroad for my staff, for example, but they don't want to. So we have our office, for example, in Chernivtsi, and I'm literally asking every single day, I ask every single day my colleagues, please, could you just travel, work from this place? And they don't want to. They want to stay in Kiev. They want to stay in our office, even with blackouts, with everything. And if you're asking me, are they exhausted? Of course they are. I heard from my editorial staff a lot of stories about their dreams, about their phobias. And I mentioned before that my colleagues lost their parents, their loved ones. And I asked them to tell the story about it, like the best way how to survive during your trauma and how to go through this trauma. I think that it's about writing. And I asked mm-hmm. them just to share their thoughts, and we published those stories.
A year has passed, mm-hmm. and as we know, the war certainly did not go as Vladimir Putin had expected. And yes, it's absolutely true that Putin has recklessly sent in many, many Russian troops who are mm-hmm. inexperienced, untrained, and get killed very quickly, but he doesn't seem to care. He doesn't seem to care how much goes into the yes. meat grinder, whether it's his own people, much, much less Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. Is time on your side, on Ukraine's side, or is it on Russia's side?
It's not on our side, because every single life for Ukraine matters. And every single day, Ukraine lost people, and the best people in our country. We don't have a professional, it's not about professional army. You know, like a lot of my friends, they joined army and they were artists. They were journalists, they were producers in normal life. And some of them were already killed. And I'm thinking about that this producer will not produce like wonderful films after that. This journalist will not write his articles. That's why everyone dreams about this war and will end as soon as possible for Ukrainian people. But at the same time, we don't want to trade our territories. We don't want to give up. We don't want to live under occupation. And that's why we are fighting, and we will fight to the end, and how much time we will need for that.
Tell me this, a year into the war, a year into this hell, you're still a young person and running a newspaper. Can you see a world after the war? And what is the Ukraine that you see after the war? What kind of life?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was 17 years old when the first Orange Revolution took place in Ukraine. Then in 2014, I was like 26 years old, investigative reporter, and I investigated also misconducts of Yanukovych. And now I'm 35, and this is full-scale war. You know, I dream about, I have my personal dream to celebrate like maybe my 50th anniversary in Free Crimea together with my kids and my family. This is like a picture, how to say, idealistic picture from the future. But I do believe that this is kind of an appointment for my generation that was born in Soviet Empire, and I was born in Soviet Union. I was born in Uzbekistan, because people of my nation were terribly deported by Stalin, in order of Stalin, mm-hmm. and then we came back to Crimea. And we have to destroy this Soviet Empire and like the ghost of the Soviet Empire. And this is a goal of our generation that like a lot of my the people of my generation, they don't have family, they don't have kids, they just dedicate their lives and the best years of their lives to country.
Sevgil Moiseeva is the editor-in-chief of the news site Ukrainskaya Pravda, Ukrainian Truth. You can find an English translation at pravda.com.ua. Pravda.com.ua. Now we're going to continue looking at a year of the war and Ukraine's prospects for the future. That's all coming up on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. When Russia invaded Ukraine a year ago, one of the first people I reached out to was Stephen Kotkin. Kotkin is a historian of Russia, and he's written major works on the Soviet period, and his biography of Stalin, which is in progress, is astonishing. He's written two volumes of a projected three. He's also extremely active in looking at current geopolitical questions. Kotkin and I spoke in March of 2022, and I talked with him again the other day to get a long view of Putin's campaign of destruction, what it's done to Ukraine, what it's done to Russia, and how this war can possibly end. Stephen, last year you told me at an early stage of the war that Ukraine was winning the war only on Twitter, but that Russia was winning the war on the battlefield. A lot has happened since then. But is that still the case?
Unfortunately, let's think of a house. Let's say that you own a house and it has 10 rooms. And let's say that I barge in and take two of those rooms away. And I wreck those rooms. And from those two rooms, I'm wrecking your other 8 rooms. And you're trying to beat me back. You're trying to evict me from the two rooms. But I'm still there and I'm still wrecking. And the thing is you need your house. That's where you live. Maybe it's not a perfect house, but it's your house. And you don't have another house. Me, I've got another house. So I don't actually need yours. And so if I wreck your house, are you winning or am I winning? And so unfortunately, that's the situation we're in. Ukraine has beaten back the Russian attempt to conquer their country. They have defended their capital. They've pushed the Russians out of some of the land that the Russians conquered since February 24th, 2022. About half of it, they've regained, the Ukrainians. And yet, they need their house, and the Russians are wrecking it. So, like I said from the beginning, Putin's strategy could be described as, I can't have it. Nobody can have it. And sadly, that's where the tragedy is right now.
I know assessing the thinking of a dictator from this distance and with minimal to no sources is a very difficult thing to do. But how do you even begin to analyze Putin as a strategic figure in this horrendous drama?
So he's not a strategic figure. People kept saying he was a tactical genius. He was playing a weak hand well. And I kept telling people, seriously? How does that work? This is prior to the war. And so if you look at the ingredients of what makes strategy, how you build a country's prosperity, how you build its human capital, its infrastructure, its governance, all the things that make a country successful, there was no evidence that any of the things that were attributed to his tactical genius or tactical agility were contributing in a positive way to Russia's long-term power. So how is that strategic for him? What is it that he's gained? If you look over the landscape, he's hurt Russia's reputation far worse than it ever was. He consolidated the Ukrainian nation whose existence he denied. He's got Sweden applying for NATO membership, right? If you know anything about the last 200 years or so of history, you would never have thought that you would have uttered that sentence. And so all across the board, it's a disaster. The problem is he's in power. He's got a lot of assets. He can wreck other people's stuff as he's doing. And he can do worse than he's doing so far. And so it's tragic for the Ukrainians in the first instance. But it's also tragic for the Russians. He smeared that country with a criminal aggression. And so he's wrecking his own country in a way, although in a very different way from the murdering that he's carrying out in Ukraine.
What has been revealed about Russia's military and Russia's intelligence capabilities in the past year?
We've had some very pleasant surprises. The war is a tragedy. There's no way to spin it as other than tragic, given what's happened, the number of deaths in Ukraine, the amount of destruction, the consequences for other countries, including food insecurity. But there have been some pleasant surprises. One was Ukrainians' ability and will to fight. It's been very inspiring from the get-go. We knew they would fight to a certain extent because they overthrew domestic dictators, 2004 and 2013-14. And so we knew that they would resist, but nonetheless, for myself as well, it's been a pleasant surprise, the depth of their courage and resistance. The other pleasant surprise has been Russia's failures. Once again, we knew that there were issues with Russia. Many of us thought that the Russian army was really only about 30,000 or 50,000 strong maximum in terms of trained fighters who had up-to-date kit as opposed to hundreds of thousands of dog food eating, conscript type, untrained or poorly trained, badly equipped soldiers under corrupt officers. Europe's adaptability and fortitude, right? Everybody said if Europe doesn't have its cappuccinos in the morning and its espressos after lunch, that there's no way they could put up with this. And look what's happened. They switched from their dependence on Russian energy much faster than anybody thought. They braved the winter, and they've rallied in support of Ukraine pretty much across the board. Yes, there are some issues. Yes, there's some domestic politics in Europe, but it's been very impressive. Then there's been what I would call an unfavorable surprise, and that's the fact that the Russian economy has done really strongly despite the sanctions. Sanctions are a controversial issue. Sanctions effectiveness is often determined by how you define the effectiveness. People on both sides can define it for their own purposes to make their arguments work. But it's clear that the Russian economy didn't shrink, let alone shrink massively. It turns out that the Russian people proved extremely adaptable to the sanction regime and figured out how to survive and in some cases how to prosper. So that Russian imports are back and Russian exports are back and Russian jobs. So it turns out that the sanctions are not having the effect of inflicting severe pain in the short term, for sure, on the Russian economy, despite the massive big bang nature of the banking sanctions and some of the other things.
Steve, last year we talked about this idea from the Chinese philosopher Sun Tzu, the great Chinese theorist of war, who said that you have to build your opponent a golden bridge so that he can find a way to retreat. A year later, do you have any thoughts on what that might look like? And is anybody even thinking about it at this point?
Yeah. So that would be a great thing if we could do that. But there's nothing like that in sight. So as we've discussed previously, you win the war on the battlefield. And the problem with the battlefield is that victory is misdefined here. You have to win on the battlefield, but how do you then win the peace as well? What would winning the peace look like? We know you can win on the battlefield and lose the peace. So here we are with Ukraine and their definition of victory, as expressed by President Zelensky, who is certainly more than risen to the occasion, as everybody has seen. It's completely understandable from a humanitarian point of view, given the atrocities Russia is committing. And his definition of victory is regain every inch of territory, reparations, and war crimes tribunals. So how would Ukraine enact that definition of victory? They would have to take Moscow. How else can you get reparations and war crimes tribunals, even if you can get every inch of territory? They're not that close to regaining every inch of their own territory, let alone the other aims. If you look at the American definition of what the victory might look like, we've been very hesitant. The Biden administration has been very careful to say Ukraine is fighting, Ukrainians are dying, they get to decide. And so the Biden administration has effectively defined victory from the American point of view as Ukraine can't lose this war. Russia can't take all of Ukraine and occupy Ukraine and disappear Ukraine as a state, as a nation in the world.
Well, that may be so, but what does Biden actually mean? What would Biden really like to see and U.S. intelligence and the U.S. military like to see in terms of a shift in attitude, if that's the case?
Well, it's slowly but surely increasing our support for Ukraine. And so we've given enough so that Ukraine doesn't lose, that they can continue the battle and maybe push a little more on the battlefield, regain a little bit more territory, and be in a better place to negotiate. Here's the better definition of victory. Ukrainians rose up against their domestic tyrants. Why? Because they wanted to join Europe. Their goal was to be part of Europe. It's the same goal that they have now, and that has to be the definition of victory. Ukraine gets into the EU. If Ukraine regains all of its territory and doesn't get into the EU, is that a victory? As opposed to if Ukraine regains as much of its territory as it physically can on the battlefield, not all of it potentially, but does get EU accession, would that be a definition of victory? Of course it would be.
Well, says you, but would the Ukrainian leadership and the Ukrainian people accept a situation in which they're in the EU, but Donbass and Crimea remain in Russian hands?
Well, you accept it or you don't accept it, meaning you continue to fight. And if you continue to fight, your country, your people continue to die and your infrastructure continues to get ruined. Your schools, your hospitals, your cultural artifacts get bombed or stolen. Your children get taken away as orphans. That's where we are right now. If we get every inch of territory back, and we're not close to that, we still need an EU accession process. It'll need a demilitarized zone. No matter how much territory it gets back, including if it somehow gets Crimea back, it's got the problem that next year, the year after next, this could happen again.
But I sense, Steve, on the Ukrainian side, for example, the other day in the Washington Post, there was an interview with the very young head of Ukrainian intelligence. What did I get out of the interview? A sense of optimism that includes not only doing well on the battlefield, but getting back Crimea within the next year.
Yeah, and the Russians shoot 50 Iranian drones over Ukraine, and the Ukrainians shoot down 75 of them. I mean, of course we fully understand Ukrainian intelligence has to be optimistic. He's not going to go in the Washington Post and say, our chances of taking Crimea are next to zero. We're going to have another 100,000 casualties over the course of the next year or so, even if the tanks arrive by May or late April. He can't say stuff like that. We want it to be true because we want a shortcut to a Ukrainian victory. The problem is we have to live in the circumstances we've got. You're in a situation, David, where you have to think about not just the spring offensive, not just how many tanks we may be able to get over there. By the way, tanks in World War II averaged about 4.5 days of life on the battlefield. And you need massive workshops to repair them.
And Western patience and Western supplies is not a given for all kinds of factors having to do with various European factors. You have a Republican Congress now that is not as likely to accede to Ukrainian requests as the Democratic one was, ironically, considering Cold War realities. Am I right?
I'm not worried about resolve here. I came up with this equation early in the process, which is Ukrainian valor plus Russian atrocities equals Western unity and resolve. Mm-hmm. And it's held. But there's been a ceiling on how far we would go in assisting the Ukrainians because we don't want an escalation of direct confrontation with the Russians or Russians using some of the capabilities that Putin has that we all know about and we're right to be concerned about. People say, well, it would be irrational if Putin were to use nuclear weapons. It would be self-defeating. He would just get destroyed himself in retaliation. And the answer is, from our point of view, certainly that would be really stupid. Just like this war. Starting this war looks really stupid from our point of view. But here's the problem. He's got a lot of capabilities short of nuclear weapons. He could poison the water supply in Kiev with chemical and biological weapons. He could poison the water supply in London, and then he could deny that it's his special operatives are doing that. He can blow up the infrastructure that carries gas or other energy supplies to Europe.
What does restrain him?
We don't know. You tell me. When someone has these capabilities, you have to pay attention. You can't say, oh, you know, that would be crazy if he did that. That would be totally self-defeating. What idiot would do that? And the answer is, okay, but what if he does it? And so we have to be concerned about escalation. And so, yes, I have been in favor of greater supply more quickly of more weapons to the Ukrainians from the beginning, but not because I'm blasé about the capabilities that Russia has.
Why are you in favor of that?
Because I think the Ukrainians deserve the chance to try to win on the battlefield.
Before then having to sit down and make concessions with the Russians.
And you have to sit down across from your murderer, representatives of your murderer, and you got to do a deal where your murderer takes some of the stuff he has stolen and killed your people in the process. That's a terrible outcome, but that's an outcome which is maybe not the worst outcome. The point being that if you get EU accession, it balances the concessions you have to make. The EU is a separate problem. EU accession is a torturous undertaking. It's probably like editing 8,000-word articles for The New Yorker to wrestle them down to 3,000 words.
I would never do that.
There are many forms of torture, but EU accession is one of them. I'm talking about a Ukrainian victory here, not a Russian victory. There are many issues with Ukraine. Their young people are in exile, going to school in Poland and other countries. Will those people come back?
How big is the Ukrainian exile been, or how many Ukrainians have left?
We're in the millions.
Yeah.
We don't know exactly, but we're in the multi-millions. And that's your future. That's the future of your country. The hope is that It's temporary and they get them back. So you then have a reconstruction issue. Even if you win, you're wrecked. So you got to have reconstruction. You know what kind of numbers we're talking about? $350 billion is one of the numbers being tossed around.
If, who knows if what things the ended actual, today.
Yeah. Who knows what the actual number is? What was Ukrainian GDP before the war? About $180 billion. So you're talking double GDP in reconstruction funds has to somehow enter that country and not disappear, not vanish. And so you're talking double their pre-war GDP. So for that, you need functioning institutions, not wartime resistance institutions. And so Ukraine is winning in the sense of we didn't allow Russia to take that whole country, but it's losing in the sense that its country is being destroyed. And what we want is the country to be built, not destroyed, in whatever size of that country that they're able to hold on to with our material support. So let's fix the EU accession process, right? North Macedonia is waiting longer than you wait for your DoorDash by a lot to get into the EU.
I somehow think the accession for Ukraine would be accelerated.
We would have to see. The EU requires some reform here. The EU, like the United States, is an imperfect institution. The problem with the EU, David, is there's no middle ground where you get partway in.
Yeah.
So you start the accession, you check some of the boxes, and then they say, great. And then you got to check more boxes, and 5 more years go by. It's either you're in or you're not in. You can't be part in, and that's the situation in the Western Balkans. We can't have that happen to Ukraine. After all the sacrifices that they've undertaken, it would be tragic if we let them down that way.
Stephen Kotkin is a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and a biographer of Joseph Stalin. A longer version of our conversation appears in the New Yorker's second annual interviews issue, which has been running online throughout the week. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and I'm going to turn things over now to Michael Shulman, a staff writer at the magazine who covers culture and entertainment.
In preparing to interview Angela Bassett, I kind of threw myself an Angela Bassett film festival. I went back and watched or rewatched her great film performances from the 90s. There's her titanic star-making performance as Tina Turner in What's Love Got to Do with It. And she kind of ruled the screen in the 90s. And she's worked really steadily since, but you know, she's had this really interesting resurgence lately thanks to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Angela plays Queen Ramonda in the Black Panther movies, and she's nominated for Best Supporting Actress this year for Black Panther Wakanda Forever. And she's actually the first actor to be nominated for a Marvel movie for an Academy Award. We talked about her role in the Black Panther movies, and I was curious about the particular challenges of acting in a Marvel movie. For instance, do you have to act a lot in front of a green screen?
Well, here's the thing. We did very little on the green screen here. So the throne room, The throne room was there. Looking through the floor, maybe outside of the throne room, that's not there. But everything, and it's humongous, it's huge.
Jure, there's something that I need to tell you about your brother.
We had trees and bushes, and we had water. We had water for, you know, yards and yards and yards and yards and yards. And Namor came up out of the water.
I am not a woman who enjoys repeating herself. Who are you?
So part of what you've done in this role as Queen Ramonda in the Black Panther films, you know, they take place in Africa, but in an imaginary country, Wakanda. How did you develop the accent for this, you know, imaginary nation? Did you have sort of accent coaching, or
how did
you get into the accent?
No, we absolutely did. We had the same coach, Miss Beth, and she's there on set. And I would grab maybe three key phrases that I found on YouTube of Winnie Mandela or of certain South African women, maybe a worker. And before a scene, I would recite them to get me, you know, in the space. You say, he didn't want to play around. He just wanted to marry me, you know. And so I would say it, you know, he didn't want to play around with me, I must say. He just wanted to marry me, you know. So that would sort of get me in the zone.
There was another attack on one of our outreach facilities. Proof of the involvement of a member state is being uploaded to your mobile devices as we speak. And as for the identity of the attackers.
Angela grew up in St. Petersburg, Florida. She lived there with her younger sister and her mother, a social worker, who had her own instinct for performing.
When we were young, my mother, my sister, we would often, you know, gather around the stereo and pick out a favorite song of the day. And mine might be Gladys Knight, I Heard It Through the Grapevine, you know, or Nancy Wilson, Guess Who I Saw Today, you know, a real story.
Guess who I saw today, my dear? I went in town to shop around for something new.
Later, when I was in an enrichment program, Upward Bound, at Eckerd College, you know, we would have talent nights, or we would have Miss Upward Bound or something like that, and you would have to display a talent. And I couldn't sing or tap dance, but I loved poetry. So I found poetry and recitation. I found an album of Ruby Dee's where she did, you know, the poems of Langston Hughes. Hmm. So, and I heard it was more than just reciting the poems, the words. It was more than that. She put something in there with it.
To fling my arms wide in some place of the sun, to whirl and to dance till the white day is done, then rest at cool evening beneath a tall tree while night comes on gently, dark. Like
she stirred something in there with it, some fire, some heat, some excitement. And it just opened up my whole imagination. And so I copied her. I took about three of those poems and I strung them together, and I did this very long poem, and it's got this repetitive thing going on with it, you know, sin for this one, sin for that one, and if they don't come, sin for Robespierre, and it just goes on and on and on, and nobody comes, sin for me. And the audience just stood up and they clapped and they clapped and they responded, and my knees got very weak, and I was, you know, trying not to go down on them, you know, and it was just the first recognition that for me at 15, that that drama, that theater, that words, that passion from one human being could move another. And then maybe I had something, maybe I had a gift for it.
Well, you really spent your 20s as a working actor, a lot of it in New York. You were doing sort of parts in soap operas or sitcoms or what have you. What were you being cast as when you were just going out for roles in your 20s, trying to make it?
Graduated from school and maybe about a year later got cast as an understudy in a bus and truck tour of this play called Colored People's Time, which was from the Negro Ensemble Company. So this theater that I'd done one of my theses on at Yale. This was an old play that they had done. They took it around to Syracuse and different little places like that. Sam Jackson was in it, I remember. L. Scott Caldwell, on and on. Carol Maylard, who's a member of Sweet Honey and the Rock. So different, you know, just working actors in New York. There wasn't a lot of television in New York at that time. I think there was The Equalizer and The Cosby Show. I remember I got a Kentucky Fried Chicken commercial, and I was happy chicken. I like Kentucky Fried until about the fourth hour. Then I hated chicken. Then I hate Kentucky Fried Chicken.
And did you have like day jobs throughout this time? Like I read that you worked at as a receptionist at a beauty salon.
Georgette Klinger Salon. It was a challenge because I had my, you know, my agent, they're sending you out and trying to do this thing that I've studied for, that I have these loans for. So I'm, you know, in this little hallway sitting next to other ladies answering the phone and booking appointments for facials with Miss Katrina and Miss Jocelyn and Miss whoever from Europe. And I think they had one lady from Jamaica. But we would have literally 45 minutes off for lunch, you know, on the east side of New York, on Madison Avenue. Because I would run in, I would blurt out the audition and then try to run back uptown and cross town. And then I would get reprimanded for being 10 minutes late or whatever. It was just so stressful. I knew I can't give my best in the auditions because I'm worried about getting back to work on time. So I heard about another job that came up, gave my notice at the salon, and I went to Rockefeller Center, one of those tall buildings, and start working for this one gentleman. He would send me to AP, Associated Press, to their photo departments. He said, oh, I need slides on what's going on, you know, in this war, this situation, or whatever. And I would go show him and say, oh, it's Friday, and I need you to take these slides and fly them to DC to the office on the shuttle. Oh, okay. So I get to do that a couple times. That's exciting. And I said, oh, I have an audition. When's your audition? I was like, it's at 2. Well, it's 12. Do you need to go get ready? Go get ready. I just couldn't believe it. He knew that, you know, this was a means to an end, that here with him was not the end.
Well, let's talk for a moment about What's Love Got to Do with It. An absolutely incredible film. From what I've read, it was a really difficult shoot. You were the film was trying to open during Tina's world tour, and you've said you were working 20-hour days. You know, fractured a hand. You were dancing in high heels. What was it like to film, and how did you cope with the incredibly hard work and the pressure of making it?
I just remember thinking, you might lose a battle, but we're trying to win a war. So you just kept going and going and going. And that's how you did it, you know? I would literally put on my earphones, put in the CD disc or whatever. I'm listening to her songs and listen to it till I fall asleep. I would listen to half a phrase over and over and over and over and over again and try to dissect it. You know, did she inhale? Did she exhale? Did she, you know, and I would just study each and every detail within a phrase or half a phrase. There's something on my mind. I would just study the O part, you know, to get it perfectly right. Did she inhale before she said that? Did she exhale at the end of that?
Oh, somebody please, please tell me what's wrong. You're just a fool, you know you're in love.
What do you say? I think I lost my voice a couple times. They would send someone, a doctor, who would put some tubing up through the sinuses, which is very scary. And even though it wasn't my vocals you were hearing, I was certainly full out singing. Getting up at 5 a.m., working out with Michael Peters, who worked famously with Michael Jackson. I love that. And he would just put me through the paces for about 10 hours. I literally would eat standing up. I never sat at a table and enjoyed breakfast, lunch, or dinner. I was just so frazzled on black coffee, plain chicken breast, and white potatoes, and green beans. That's literally all that I ate during that time. Working out, everything hurt. Just shred it down. We would do a dance number and they'd say, okay, cut. All right, let's do it again. And I literally say, can an actor just have 60 seconds? Can we have 60 seconds? Because it felt as if you had swallowed a wool sweater. You're like, just trying to get your breath at the end of it.
You know, every now and then, I think you might like to hear something from us. Nice and easy. But there's just one thing. You see, we never ever do nothing nice and easy.
And this role really just catapulted you into this echelon of stardom. You know, you did these two movies, Waiting to Exhale and How Stella Got Her Groove Back, that are you know, they're almost like a genre unto themselves, like these movies that were being made sort of around you about the romantic lives of Black women. And I mean, what did it feel like to sort of be at the center of a kind of movie being made for, you know, for an audience that hadn't been catered to in that way? I mean, did your relationship with the audience change?
It felt fantastic, felt phenomenal. You know, we hadn't seen ourselves in that way, especially Waiting to Exhale, just for a Black woman and for Black women and their friends and their support system for each other. And they're classy and they're beautiful and they're, you know, and they have, I mean, they have a joie de vivre and they have pain and they're going through things. They think they're at the end and they'll never find love. They're being dogged out, you know. And we
had... Well, it's an obvious precursor to Sex and the City.
There you go. And we let that movement, and First Wives Club and all that followed. Because before then, here we are. Yes, sir, may I get you coffee? I'm the secretary or, you know, that sort of thing. But it felt wonderful that times had changed, and here were these movies that featured Black women in complicated and loving relationships, and we could do it well, and it wasn't a joke. So I was very happy with that.
So I've noticed in the past couple of years, Angela, you've been doing a bit more comedy. I mean, there was the episode you were in of Master of None, which playing Lena Waithe's mother in the Thanksgiving episode, which was an absolutely brilliant performance in a terrific episode of television. You were in a black lady sketch show in a sketch called Angela Bassett is the Baddest Bitch. And I'm wondering, did something about comedy appeal to you, or about sort of winking to the audience about, you know, sort of your rep as this just sort of as this bad bitch that you wanted to embrace?
My whole thing was drama. I was just drama queen, just Sturm und Drang. But off camera, my friends say I'm pretty funny. So I appreciate that that's the way they saw me and that I got that opportunity, you know?
Well, I mean, you were certainly especially from the evidence of Master of None, you just have this incredible comic timing. I mean, there's a lot of incredible side-eye acting in that episode when your daughter brings home like these sort of like floozy girlfriends over Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Absolutely hysterical.
Thank you. Yeah, just someone who's, you know, doesn't understand it completely, but loves her baby and wants the best for them, so.
What is the problem? Just annoyed that I even have to have this conversation with you.
What conversation? I'm sitting here being normal. You acting like a crazy person.
Ma. I'm gay.
You what?
I'm gay.
And it was an important story to tell, an important moment. Yeah. So I was so happy that I was able to be there and the eyes that saw it and the change that happened for people who were able to speak to their parents or it spoke to them, to have those moments just from acting, whether it's What's Love and people who've been in abusive relationships and got out of it, or whether it's Stella and those who thought, well, at 40, it's over. And they say, evidently it's not. And they, book their Jamaican or their Caribbean vacation and get their groove back. To have an opportunity to speak to folk, that's been a great blessing.
Well, thank you, first of all, for all these great performances over the years that have been really fun for me to revisit. And good luck at the Oscars. Do you know what you're going to wear?
I don't, Michael Shulman. I don't. But I was looking at this frock I have on today. It's a lovely shade of purple, maybe. And purple is the color of royalty. Oh, it's such a responsibility.
The New Yorker's Michael Shulman speaking with Angela Bassett. She's nominated for an Oscar for her role in Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. The conversation also appears in written form in The New Yorker's interviews issue this week, alongside conversations with Cate Blanchett, crossword editor Will Shortz, and many more.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado and Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Brita Green, Adam Howard, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofen Mputubwele, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Harrison Keithline and Meher Bhatia. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.